Time Warner Audiobooks presents Violets Are Blue, written by James Patterson and read by Kevin O'Rourke and Daniel Whitner.
Hi, I'm James Patterson. I'm sometimes accused of writing books that can't be put down, or audiobooks that people listen to long after they reach their destinations. You know what I mean. The kind of audiobook where you sit in your car, listening for 10 minutes after you've actually reached your own driveway. I was in San Francisco recently for the launch of my novel, First to Die. I met with a famous bookstore owner there who told me she'd been in the hospital after a heart attack. She said she was reading Violets Are Blue when two doctors rushed into her room. Her monitors were going crazy. The doctors told her that she couldn't read any more James Patterson novels until she got out of the hospital. Here's another story from the movies, and movie stories are always the best. My wife and I went to the shoot for the movie they made of my book, Along Came a Spider. Afterward, we went out to dinner with Morgan Freeman and Monica Potter. What a blast. When dinner was finished, we all stood up at the table. Up walked Senator Fred Thompson from Tennessee and Clint Eastwood. Everybody in the restaurant was gawking at us. Finally, this guy came up for an autograph. My autograph. Clint Eastwood looked down at the guy and he said, "I need a hit movie. Bad." So anyway, I hope you enjoy Violets Are Blue. Alex Cross is back with a vengeance. Just don't listen to it in the hospital if you're having heart trouble. And I hope the audiobook for Violets Are Blue keeps you sitting in the car in your driveway for a few extra minutes. By the way, if you haven't listened to First to Die yet, you might pick that one up next. You won't stop listening until you're finished. And now, Violets Are Blue.
Prologue. Without any warning. Chapter 1. Nothing ever starts where we think it does. So, of course, this doesn't begin with the vicious and cowardly murder of an FBI agent and good friend named Betsy Cavalier. I only thought that it did. My mistake. And a really big and painful one. I arrived at Betsy's house in Woodbridge, Virginia, in the middle of the night. I'd never been there before, but I didn't have any trouble finding it. The FBI and EMS were already there. There were flashing red and yellow lights everywhere, seeming to paint the lawn and front porch with bright, dangerous streaks. I took a deep breath and walked inside. My sense of balance was off. I was reeling. I acknowledged a tall, blonde FBI agent I knew named Sandy Hammonds. I could see that Sandy had been crying. She was a friend of Betsy's. On a hallway table, I saw Betsy's service revolver. Beside it was a printed reminder for her next shooting qualifier at the FBI range. The irony stung. I forced myself to walk down a long hallway that led from the living room to the back of the house. The house looked to be close to 100 years old and was filled with the kind of country clutter that she loved. The master bedroom was situated at the end of the hall. I knew instantly that the murder had happened in there. The FBI techs and the local police were swarming around the open door like angry wasps near a threatened hive. The house was strangely, eerily quiet. This was as bad as it gets. Worse than anything else, ever. Another one of my partners was dead. The second one brutally murdered in 2 years. And Betsy had been much more than just a partner. How could this have happened? What did it mean? I saw Betsy's small body sprawled on the hardwood floor, and I went cold. My hand flew to my face, a reflex I had no control over. The killer had stripped off her nightclothes. I didn't see them anywhere in the bedroom. The lower body was coated with blood. He'd used a knife. He'd punished Betsy with it. I desperately wanted to cover her, but I knew I couldn't. Betsy's brown eyes were staring up at me, but they saw nothing. I remembered kissing those eyes and that sweet face. I remembered Betsy's laugh, high-pitched and musical. I stood there for a long time, mourning Betsy, missing her terribly. I wanted to turn away, but I didn't. I just couldn't leave her like this. As I stood there in the bedroom, trying to figure out something coherent about Betsy's murder, the cell phone in my jacket pocket went off. I jumped. I grabbed it. But then I hesitated. I didn't want to answer. Alex Cross, I finally spoke into the receiver. I heard a machine-filtered voice, and it cut right through me. I shuddered against my will. I know who this is, and I even know where you are. At poor, dear, butchered Betsy's. Do you feel a little bit like a puppet on a string, detective? You should, said the mastermind, because that's what you are. You are my favorite puppet, in fact.
Why did you kill her? I asked the monster. You didn't have to do this.
He laughed a mechanical laugh, and the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. You ought to be able to figure that out, no? You're the famous detective Alex Cross. You have all those big, important cases notched on your belt. You caught Gary Sonigi, Casanova. You solved Jack and Jill. Christ, you're impressive.
I spoke in a low voice. Why don't you come after me right now? How about tonight? As you say, you know where I am.
The mastermind laughed again, quietly, almost under his breath. How about I kill your grandmother and your three kids tonight? I know where they are, too. You left your partner with them, didn't you? You think he can stop me? John Sampson doesn't have a chance against me.
I hung up and ran out of the house in Woodbridge. I called Sampson in Washington, and he picked up on the second ring. Everything okay there? I gasped.
Everything's fine, Alex. No problems here. You don't sound too good, though. What's up? What happened?
He said he's coming for you and Nana and the kids, I told John. The mastermind.
Not going to happen, sugar. Nobody will get past me. I hope to hell he tries.
Be careful, John. I'm on my way back to Washington right now. Please be careful. He's crazy. He didn't just kill Betsy. He defiled her.
I ended the call with Sampson, and I sprinted full out toward my old Porsche. The cell phone rang again before I got to the car.
Cross, I answered, still running as I spoke, trying to steady the phone against my chin and ear. It was him again. He was laughing maniacally.
You can relax, Dr. Cross. I can hear your labored breathing. I'm not going to hurt them tonight. I was just fucking with you, having some fun at your expense. You're running, aren't you? Keep running, Dr. Cross, but you won't be fast enough. You can't get away from me. It's you I want. You're next, Dr. Cross.
Part 1. The California Murders.
Chapter 2. United States Army Lieutenant Martha Wyatt and her boyfriend, Sergeant Davis O'Hara, moved at a fast pace as the evening fog began to roll in like a sulfurous cloud across Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. The couple looked sleek, even beautiful in the waning light of day. Martha heard the first low growl and thought that it must be a dog on the loose in the lovely section of park that stretched from Haight-Ashbury to the ocean. It came from far enough behind them that she wasn't worried. The big dog, she kidded Davis as they jogged up a steep hill that offered a stellar view of the stunning suspension bridge connecting San Francisco to Marin County. Big dog was a pet expression they used for everything oversized, from jetliners to sexual apparatus to very large canines. Soon the thick fog would blanket the bridge and bay completely, but for now it was a gorgeous sight, incomparable, one of their favorite things in San Francisco. I love this run, that beautiful bridge, the sunset, the whole ball of wax, Martha said in a steady, relaxed cadence. But enough bad poetry, it's time for me to kick your well-formed, athletic-looking butt, O'Hara. That sounds like cheap-shot female chauvinism to me, he grunted. But he was grinning, showing off some of the whitest teeth she had ever seen or run her tongue across. Martha kicked her pace up a notch. She'd been a cross-country star at Pepperdine University, and she was still in great shape. And that sounds like the beginnings of a gracious loser's speech, she said. We'll see about that, won't we? Loser buys at the Abbey. I can already taste a Dos Equis. Good. Suddenly, the two runners' playful exchange was interrupted by a much louder growl. It was closer, too. It didn't seem possible that a dog had covered so much ground so fast, Maybe there were a couple of big dogs loose in the area. "There aren't any cats in this park," Davis asked. "I mean, like a mountain lion variety of cats." "No, of course not. Get real, pal. We're in San Francisco, not the middle of Montana." Martha shook her head. Moisture jumped off her close-cropped reddish-brown hair. Then she thought she heard footsteps. A runner and a large dog? "Let's get out of these woods, okay?" Davis asked. "I hear you. I don't necessarily disagree. Last one to the parking lot is Dog Chow." "Not funny, Lieutenant Martha. Bad joke. This is getting a little spooky." "I don't know about big cats around these parts, but I think I just spotted a little pussy." Another loud growl, and it was really close. Right on the heels of the two of them, gaining ground fast. "Come on, let's go. Let's move it," said Martha Wyatt. She was a little afraid now, running as fast as she could, and that was very fast. Another eerie growl pierced the gathering fog. Chapter 3. Lieutenant Martha Wyatt had definitely picked up her pace. The distance between her and Davis was growing. She did triathlons for fun. He worked behind a desk, though God knows he certainly looked good for an accountant. "Come on, come on, keep up with me, Davis, don't fall back," she called over her shoulder. Her boyfriend for the past year didn't answer. Well, that settled any future debate about who was in better shape, who was the real athlete. Of course, Martha had known that all along. The sounds of the next growl, and also heavy footsteps crushing leaves, were even closer. They were catching up to her. But what was catching up to her? "Martha, there's something behind me. Oh, God, run. Run, Martha," Davis shouted. "Get the hell out of here." Adrenaline charged through her. She pushed her head in front of her body as if she were trying for an invisible finish line. Her arms and legs moved in sync like efficient pistons. She leaned her weight forward, the way all good runners do. She heard more screams behind her. She looked back, but she couldn't see Davis anymore. The screams were so terrifying that she almost stopped running, but Davis had been attacked by something vicious. Martha rationalized that she had to get help. The police, somebody. Her boyfriend's screams were ringing in her ears, and she was running in total panic, not aware of where she was going. She stumbled over a pointy rock and cartwheeled down a steep hill. Martha crashed into the base of a small tree, but at least it stopped her fall. In a daze, she managed to pull herself up. Jesus, she was pretty sure she'd broken her right arm. Cradling it with the left, she ran forward in a clumsy stumble. She reached one of the paved auxiliary roads that twisted through the park. Davis's screams had stopped. What had happened to him? She had to get help. She saw a pair of headlights approaching and Martha ran out into the middle of the road. She straddled the double center line and felt like a total madwoman. For God's sake, this was San Francisco. "Please, stop, please stop. Hey, hey, hey!" She waved her good arm and shouted at the top of her voice. "Stop, I need help!" The white van sped straight for her, but then, thank God, it skidded to a stop. Two men jumped out and ran to her. They would help. The van said Red Cross on its hood. "Help me, please," Martha said. "My boyfriend is hurt." Everything went from bad to worse. One of them hit her with a closed fist. Before Martha realized what was happening, she went down hard. Her chin struck the pavement, bouncing like a wet ball. She was knocked almost unconscious by the powerful blow. She looked up, tried to focus her eyes, and wished she hadn't. Blazing red eyes stared down at her. A mouth was open wide. Two horrible mouths. She had never seen such teeth in her life. They were like sharpened knives. The incisors were huge. She felt the teeth bite into her cheeks, then her neck. How could that be? The teeth tore into her, and Martha screamed until her throat was raw. She rolled and twisted and kicked out at her attackers, but it did no good. They were incredibly strong. Both of them were growling. Ecstasy. One of them whispered against Martha's ear. "Isn't it beautiful? You're so lucky. You were chosen out of all the beautiful people in San Francisco. You and Davis."
Chapter 4.
It was a perfect blue-skied morning in Washington. Well, almost perfect. The mastermind was on my cell phone.
Hello, Alex. Did you miss me? I missed you, partner.
The bastard had been making obscene, threatening phone calls to me every morning for over a week. Sometimes he just cursed at me for several minutes. This morning, he sounded positively civil.
What's your day look like? Any big plans?
He asked. Actually, yes. I was planning to catch him. I was inside an FBI van that was already on the move. We were tracing his call and expected to have the exact location very soon. A court order had been put through the FBI, and the phone company was involved in trapping the call. I was in the rear of the speeding van with three bureau agents, and also my partner, John Sampson. We had left my house on 5th Street as soon as the call came in. We were heading on to I-395 North. My job was to keep him on the line until the trace was completed.
Tell me about Betsy Cavalier. Why did you pick her instead of me? I asked him.
Oh, she's much, much prettier, the mastermind said. More fuckable.
One of the techie agents was talking in the background. I tried to listen to both conversations. The agent said,
He's living up to his name.
We've got a wiretap and should be able to trace this call immediately. It isn't happening for some reason.
Why the hell not? Samson asked, and moved closer to the agents.
Don't know exactly. We're picking up different locations, but they keep changing. Maybe he's on a cell phone in a car. Cell phones are harder to trace.
I could see that we were getting off the D Street exit. Then we headed into the 3rd Street tunnel. Where was he?
Everything all right, Alex? You seem a little distracted, the mastermind said.
No, I'm right here with you, partner. Enjoying our little breakfast club.
I don't know why this is so goddamn hard, the FBI techie complained.
Because he's the mastermind, I wanted to yell at him. I saw the Washington Convention Center on the right. The van was really clipping along, doing 60 or 70 on the city streets. We passed the Renaissance Hotel. Where the hell was the mastermind calling from?
I think we have a fix on him. We're real close,
one of the young agents said in an excited voice. The FBI van stopped, and suddenly it was chaos inside. Samson and I pulled out our guns. We had him. I couldn't believe we had him. Then everyone inside the van groaned and cursed. I looked outside and saw why. I shook my head in disgust.
Jesus Christ, do you believe this shit?
Samson yelled, and pounded the wall of the van. We were at 935 Pennsylvania Avenue, the J. Edgar Hoover building, which is FBI headquarters.
What's happening now? I asked the agent in charge. Where the hell is he?
Shit, the signal is roaming again. It's moving outside Washington. Okay, now it's back in the city. Christ, the signal just skipped out of the country.
Goodbye, Alex. For now, anyway. As I told you before, you're next,
the mastermind said. And then he hung up on me. Chapter 5. The rest of my day was long, hard, and depressing. More than anything, I needed a break from the mastermind. I'm not exactly sure when or where or how I had gotten up the nerve, but I had a date that night. It was with a lawyer for the DA's office here in Washington. Elizabeth Moore was wickedly funny and nicely irreverent. She was a large woman with a really sweet smile that made me smile. We were having dinner at Marcel's in Foggy Bottom, which is a good spot for this kind of thing. The food is French with a Flemish flair. The night couldn't have been going any better. I thought so, and I was pretty sure that Elizabeth would agree. After the waiter left with our orders for dessert and coffee, Elizabeth put her hand lightly on top of mine. Our table was lit by a simple votive candle in a crystal holder.
All right, Alex. We've gone through all the preliminaries. I enjoyed the preliminaries, she said. Now what's the catch? There has to be a catch. Has to be. All the good ones are taken. I know that from experience. So why are you still playing the dating game?
I understood exactly what Elizabeth meant, but I pretended to look slightly puzzled. Catch, I shrugged. Then I finally started to smile. She laughed out loud.
You're what, 39, 40?
42, but thanks, I said.
You passed every test I could possibly throw at you.
Such as?
Such as picking a great spot for dinner. Romantic, but not too romantic. Such as being right on time when you arrived to pick me up.
such as listening to some of the things that actually interest me, such as being very handsome. Not that it matters to me.
Yeah, right.
I also like children. Wouldn't mind having more, I added. I've read all of Toni Morrison's novels. I'm a decent plumber. I can cook if I have to.
The catch? She asked again. Let's leave it.
Our waiter returned with the coffee and desserts, and right as he was pouring a steaming cup for Elizabeth, the beeper on my belt went off.
Oh, Jesus. Busted.
I looked across the table at her, and I blinked. I was definitely the first one to blink. You mind if I take this? It's important. I recognize the number. The FBI in Quantico. I won't be long. I'll be right back. I went to the restroom area and used my cell phone. I called Kyle Craig in Virginia. Kyle had been a solid friend for many years, but ever since I became a liaison between the Bureau and the D.C. police, I'd seen way too much of him. He kept dragging me into the nastiest murder cases on the FBI's docket. I hated to take his calls anymore. Now what had happened? Kyle knew who was calling. He didn't even bother to say hello. Alex, do you remember a case you and I worked about 14 months ago? A runaway girl was found hung from a lighting fixture in her hotel room? Patricia Cameron? There have been two murders in San Francisco that match up. Happened last night in Golden Gate Park. This is a very bad scene, the worst I've heard about in a while.
Kyle, I'm having dinner with an attractive, very nice, interesting woman.
I'll talk to you tomorrow. I'll call you. I'm off duty tonight. Kyle laughed. I amused him sometimes. Nana already told me. Your date's a lawyer, right?
Listen to this one. The devil meets with this lawyer. Says he can make the lawyer a senior partner, but the lawyer has to give him his soul and the soul of everybody in his family. The lawyer stares at the devil and asks, "So what's the catch?"
After he told his joke, Kyle went on to tell me more than I wanted to hear about the similarities connecting the awful murders in San Francisco to the one in D.C. I remembered the victim, Patricia Cameron. I could still see her face. I shook off the image. When he was finished, and Kyle tends to be thorough if a bit long-winded, I went back to join Elizabeth at our table. She smiled ruefully and shook her head.
"I think I just figured out the catch," she said.
I did my best to laugh, but my insides were already tied up in knots. Honestly, it's not as bad as it looks.
It's much worse, Elizabeth.
Chapter 6.
In the morning, I dropped the kids at school on my way to the airport. Janie is 8. Damon just turned 10. They're really good kids, but they're kids. You give them a tiny advantage, they take a lot, and then they take a little more. Someone, I don't remember who, said that American children suffer too much mother and too little father. With my kids, it's been the exact opposite.
I could get used to this, Janie said, as we pulled up in front of the Sojourner Truth School.
Helen for La Sade Ardu, Sade, was singing softly on the CD. Very nice.
Don't get used to it. It's a 5-block walk from our house to school.
When I was a little boy in North Carolina, I used to walk 5 miles through tobacco fields to school.
Yeah, right, Damon scoffed. You forgot that you used to walk barefoot. Left that part out.
I did. Thanks for reminding me. I used to walk barefoot through those nasty tobacco fields to school.
The kids laughed, and so did I. They're usually good to be around, and I'm always videotaping them. I do it in the hopes that I'll have nice movies to watch when the two of them go bad in their teenage years. Also, I'm afraid I might get CRS someday. The can't-remember-shit disease? It's going around.
I have a big concert on Saturday, Damon reminded me.
It was his second year with the Washington Boys Choir, and he was doing really well. He was going to be the next Luther Vandross, or maybe Al Green. Or maybe he was just going to be Damon Cross. I'll be home by Saturday, Damon. Trust me, I wouldn't miss your concert.
You missed quite a few already, he said.
It was a sharp little dig.
Well, that was the old me. This is the new and improved Alex. I've also attended several of your concerts.
You're so funny, Daddy, Janie said and laughed.
Both kids are smart, and smart ass as well. I will be home for Damon's concert, I promised. Help your grandma around the house. She's almost 100 years old, you know. Janie rolled her eyes.
Nana's 80 years young, or so she says. She loves to cook, do the dishes, and clean up after us, she said, imitating Nana's wicked cackle. She truly does.
Saturday. I can't wait, I said to Damon. It was the whole truth and nothing but. The boys' choir was one of Washington's secret treasures. I was ecstatic that Damon was good enough to sing with the group, but most of all that he loved what he was doing. Kisses, I said. Hugs, too. Damon and Janie groaned, but they leaned in close, and I wondered how much longer they would be willing to give me hugs and pecks on the cheek, so I took an extra few while I could get them. When the good times come with your kids, you've got to make them last. I love you, I said before I let them go off to school. What do you say? We love you too, Damon and Janie chorused. That's why we let you embarrass us to death in front of our school and all our friends, Janie said, and she stuck out her tongue. Well, this is your last ride to school, I told her. Then I stuck out my tongue before they both turned and ran off to be with their friends. They were growing up way too fast for me. Chapter 7. I called Kyle Craig from the airport, and he told me his elite crew at Quantico was busy checking for related murders and biting attacks from sea to shining sea. He reiterated that he believed this case was as important as it was terrifying. I wondered what else he knew. He usually knew more than he told. Well, you're up early, Kyle, and you're busy. This case has caught your full attention. Why is that? Of course it has. It's totally unique. I haven't seen anything remotely like it. Inspector Jamila Hughes will meet your flight if she can. It's her case, and she's supposed to be competent. She's one of two women in homicide in San Francisco, so she probably is fairly good. On the plane trip from D.C., I read and reread the faxes I'd gotten that morning about the horrific murders in Golden Gate Park. Inspector Hughes's preliminary crime scene notes were precise and detailed, but most of all, gut-wrenching. I made my own notes based on hers. It was my kind of shorthand, and I used it on every case I worked. Male and female victims found dead at 3:20 a.m. in Golden Gate Park, San Francisco. Why there? Visit park if possible. Victims hung by feet from oak tree. Why hung? To drain the bodies? Why drain the bodies? Rite of purification? Spiritual cleansing? Bodies naked and covered in blood. Why naked? Erotic? Sex crimes? Or just brutal, exposing the victims to the world for some reason? Male's legs, arms, chest severely gouged. Victim appears to have been bitten repeatedly. Male actually died from bites. Female bitten, but not as severely. Also cut with sharp object. Died from massive blood loss, class 4. Female lost over 40% of her blood. Small red dots at the site of bindings to the ankles with which victims were hung, called petechiae by the ME. Teeth marks on male appear to be those of large animal. Is that even remotely possible? What animal would attack a jogger in a big city park? Seems far-fetched, to say the least. White substance on male victims' legs and stomach. Could be semen. What game were the killers playing? Sadoerotic? I remember the related case in Washington. How could I forget it? A 16-year-old runaway girl from Orlando, Florida, had been found dead and severely mutilated in a hotel room downtown. Her name was Patricia Dawn Cameron. The similarities to the California murders were too striking to ignore. The girl in D.C. had suffered savage bites all over her body. She had been hung by her feet from a hotel room lighting fixture. Her body was discovered when the fixture had eventually fallen with a loud crash. Patricia Cameron had died of blood loss, another class 4. She had lost nearly 70% of her blood supply. The first question was an obvious one. Why did somebody want all that blood? Chapter 8. I was still thinking about the strange, terrible bites and all that blood as I walked off the plane and into crowded San Francisco International Airport. I looked around for Inspector Jamila Hughes. Rumor had it that she was an attractive black woman. I noted that a businessman near the gate was reading the Examiner. I could see the bold headline on the front page. Horror in Golden Gate Park. Two murdered. I didn't see anyone waiting, so I began to look for signs directing me to public transportation. I only had a carry-on bag. I had promised to be home by Saturday for Damon's concert. I had my marching orders, and I planned to keep all my promises from now on.
cross my heart.
A woman walked up to me as I started away from the gate.
Excuse me, are you Detective Cross?
I had noticed her just before she spoke to me. She was wearing jeans and a black leather car coat over a powder blue t-shirt. Then I spotted the telltale holster under her coat. She was probably in her mid-30s. Nice looking, down to earth, pleasant for a homicide detective, who often come on a little gruff.
Inspector Hughes, I asked.
Jamila. She extended her hand and smiled as I took it. Nice smile, too.
It's good to meet you, Detective. Ordinarily, I'd resist any idea that originated with the FBI, but your reputation precedes you.
Also, the murder in D.C. was awfully similar, wasn't it?
So, welcome to San Francisco.
Good to be here. I returned the smile and shook her hand. Her grip was strong, but not overly so. I was just thinking about the murder in D.C., I told her. Your crime scene notes brought it all back to me. We never got anywhere with the murder of Patricia Cameron. You can add that to the file on my so-called reputation, the one that preceded me.
Jamila Hughes smiled again. Sincere. Nothing overdone about it. Nothing overdone about her either.
She didn't particularly look like a homicide detective, and that was probably good. She seemed a little too normal to be a cop.
Well, we'd better hurry. I've contacted a veterinary dental specialist, and he's meeting us at the city morgue. He's a good friend of the medical examiner. How's that for showing you the sights of San Francisco?
I shook my head and grinned. Actually, it's exactly what I came out here to see. I think I read about it in one of the tour books. When you're in San Francisco, don't pass up a chance to see the morgue.
It's not in the tour books, Jamila said, but it should be. It's a whole lot more interesting than any trolley car ride.
Chapter 9. Less than 50 minutes later, Jamila Hughes and I were inside the morgue at San Francisco's famed Hall of Justice. We had joined the chief medical examiner, Walter Lee, and the dental expert, Dr. Pang. Dr. Alan Pang took his time examining both bodies before he said anything to us. He had already studied photographs of the bite areas that had been taken at the crime scene. He was a small man, completely bald, with very thick black-rimmed glasses. At one point during his examination, I noticed Inspector Hughes give a wink to the ME. I think they found Dr. Pang just a little strange. So did I, but he was very thorough and obviously serious about the job he had taken on.
Okay, I'm ready to talk about the nature of the bites now.
He finally turned to us as he made this pronouncement.
I understand you're making casts of the bite marks, Walter.
Yes, we lifted the marks with fingerprint powder. The cast should be ready in a day or two. We swab to gather saliva, of course.
Well, good. That's the right approach, I think. I'm ready to state my piece, my educated guess.
That's excellent, Alan, Lee said in a soft, very dignified voice. He wore a white coat with the nickname Dragon stitched on one pocket. He was a tall man, probably 6'2", and weighed at least 250. He carried himself with confidence.
Dr. Pang is a friend I've used before, Lee told me. He's a veterinary dental expert from the Animal Medical Center in Berkeley. Alan is one of the best in the world, and we're lucky to get him on this case.
Well, thank you for your time, Dr. Pang, Inspector Hughes said. This is terrific of you to help.
Thank you, I joined in with the hallelujah chorus of gratitude.
It's perfectly all right, he said. I'm not exactly sure where to start, other than to say that these two homicides are most interesting to me. The male was severely bitten, and I'm relatively sure the attacker was, well, it was a tiger. The bites on the female were inflicted by two humans. It's as if the humans and the large cat were running together, like they were a pack. Extraordinary. And bizarre, to say the least.
A tiger?
Jamila was the one to express the disbelief we were all feeling.
Are you sure? That doesn't seem possible, Dr. Pang.
Alan, Walter Lee said, explain, please.
Well, as you know, humans are heterodonts. That is, they have teeth of different sizes and shapes, which serve different functions. Most important would be our canines, which are situated between the lateral incisor and the first premolar on each side of each jaw. The canines are used to tear food.
Walter Lee nodded, and Dr. Pang continued. He was speaking solely to the ME at this point. I caught Jamila's eye, and she gave me a wink. I liked that she had a sense of humor.
Dr. Pang continued.
He seemed to be in his own world.
In contrast to humans, some animals are homodents. Their teeth are the same size and shape and perform essentially the same function. This is not true of large cats, however, especially tigers. The teeth of tigers have been adapted for their feeding habits. Each jaw contains 6 pointed cutting teeth, 2 very sharp recurved canines, and molars that have evolved into cutting blades.
Is that important in terms of these murders? Jamila Hughes asked Dr. Pang. I had a version of the same question. The smallish man nodded enthusiastically.
Oh, of course, certainly. The jaw of a tiger is extremely strong, able to clamp down hard enough to crush bone. The jaw can only move up and down, not side to side. This means the tiger can only tear and crush food, not chew or gnaw.
He demonstrated with his own teeth and jaw. I swallowed hard and found my head shaking back and forth. A tiger was involved in these murders? How could that possibly be? Dr. Pang stopped talking. He reached up and scratched his bald pate rather vigorously. Then he said,
What completely baffles me is that someone commanded the tiger away from its prey after it struck, and the tiger obeyed. If that hadn't happened, the prey would have been eaten.
Absolutely amazing, the medical examiner said, and gave Dr. Pang a pat on the back. Then he looked at Jamila and me. What's the saying? Catch a tiger if you can. A tiger shouldn't be all that hard to find in San Francisco.
Chapter 10. The large white male tiger was making a shuffling sound, a muted backward whistle. The sucking noise came from deep inside its wide throat. The sound was almost unearthly. Birds took flight from a nearby cypress. Small animals scampered away as fast as they could. The tiger was 8 feet long, muscular, and weighed just over 580 pounds. Under ordinary circumstances, its prey would have been pigs and piglets, deer, antelope, water buffalo. There were no ordinary circumstances in California. There were lots of humans, though. The cat pounced quickly, its lithe, powerful body moving effortlessly. The young blond man didn't even try to resist. The tiger's massive jaws opened wide, then clamped down onto the man's head. The cat's jaws were strong enough to pulverize bone. The man screamed, Stop! 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 Amazingly, the tiger stopped, just like that, on verbal command. You win, the blond man laughed and patted the tiger, which released his head. The man then twisted sharply to the left. His movements were almost as quick and effortless as the cat's. Now the young man pounced. He attacked the tiger's vulnerable, creamy white underside, grabbing onto flesh with his teeth. Gotcha, you big baby. You lose. You're still my love slave. William Alexander stood off in the distance, watching his younger brother with a mixture of curiosity and awe. Michael was a beautiful man-child, incredibly graceful and athletic, strong beyond belief. He wore a black pocket t-shirt and powder blue shorts. He was already 6'3" and 185 pounds. He was flawless. Both of them were, actually. William walked away, staring into the distance at the rich green hills. He loved it out here, the beauty and the solitude, the freedom to do anything he wanted to do. He was very quiet inside, an art that he was still mastering. When he and Michael were small boys, this whole area had been a commune. Their mother and father had been hippies, experimenters, freedom lovers, massive drug takers. They had instructed the boys that the outside world was not only dangerous, but also wrong. Their mother had taught William and Michael that having sex with anyone, even with her, was a good thing, as long as it was consensual. The brothers had slept with their mother and their father and many others in the commune. Their code of personal freedom had turned bad and eventually got them 2 years at a level 4 correctional facility. They had been arrested for possession, but it was aggravated assault that put the brothers behind bars. They were suspected of much more serious crimes, but none could be proved. As William stared off at the foothills, he marveled at the concept of the unbridled mind. Day by day, he left behind the shabby baggage of his past life. Soon, he would have no false morals or ethics, or any of the other bullshit inhibitions taught in the civilized world. He was getting closer to the truth. So was Michael. William was 20. Michael was only 17. They had been killing together for 5 years, and they kept getting better and better at it. They were invincible. Immortal. Chapter 11. That night, the two brothers hunted in the town of Mill Valley in Marin County. The area was beautiful, small mountains teeming with strapping, healthy evergreen and eucalyptus trees. The redwood house was maybe 100 yards ahead, up a steep, rocky slope that they climbed with ease. A brick walkway led to an entryway with double wooden doors. "We have to go away for a while," William spoke to Michael without turning around. "We have a mission from the Sire. San Francisco is just the start." "That's excellent," Michael said, and he smiled. "I enjoyed what went down there very much. Who are these people, the ones in the big fancy house up there?" William shrugged. "Just pray. They're nobody." Michael began to pout. "Why won't you tell me who they are?" "The Sire said not to talk and not to bring the cat." Michael asked no further questions. His obedience to the Sire was complete. The Sire told you how to think, feel, and act. The Sire was accountable to no one, to no other authority. The Sire despised the straight world, as did they. This definitely looked like the straight world up ahead. The large house had all the trappings: gardens tended and watered daily, a small pond filled with koi, several layers of terraces leading up to a large house with more than a dozen rooms for just two people. How obnoxious could anyone be? William walked right in the front door, and Michael followed. The foyer had 20-foot ceilings, a ridiculous crystal chandelier, a spiral staircase to heaven. They found the couple in the kitchen, making a late meal, both of them sharing the preparations like the goody-goodies that they were. "Yuppies at play," William said and smiled. "Whoa," the male said, and threw up both of his hands. He was close to 6'4 and well-built. He was working like kitchen help at the vegetable sink. "What the hell do you guys think you're doing? Let's take it outside." "You're the troublemaking lawyer," William said, and pointed at the female. She was early 30s, short blonde hair, high cheekbones, slender, with small breasts. "We came for supper." "I'm a lawyer, too," the domineering male said. "I don't think you two were invited. I'm sure of it. Get out." "You hear me? Hey, you assholes, hit the road." "You threatened the Sire," William continued to talk to the female. "So he sent us here." "Arthur, I'm going to call the police," the woman finally said. She was upset now, the nubs of her breasts rising and falling against her shirt. She had a small cell phone in her hand, and William wondered if she had pulled it out of her ass. The thought made him smile. He was on her in an instant, and Michael took down the husband almost as easily. The brothers were incredibly fast and strong, and they knew it. They growled loudly, but that was only a scare tactic. "We have money in the house. My God, don't hurt us!" the male shrieked loudly, almost like a woman. "We're not after your obscene money. We have no use for it, and we're not serial killers or anything common like that," William told them. He bit down into the struggling woman's luscious pink neck, and she stopped fighting. Just like that, she was his. She gazed into his eyes, and she swooned. A tear ran down her cheek. William didn't look up again until he had fed. "We're vampires," he finally whispered to the murdered couple.
Chapter 12.
On my second day in San Francisco, I worked out of a small cubicle near Jamila Hughes's desk at the Hall of Justice. I attended a couple of her briefings on the Golden Gate Park murders, which were thorough and highly professional. She was impressive. Everything about the murder case was weird and wrongheaded, though. No one had a fix on it yet. No one had a good idea, at least none that I'd heard so far. The only thing we knew for sure was that people were being murdered in particularly horrible ways. It happens more and more frequently these days. Around noon, I got a call on my cell phone.
"Just checking in," the mastermind said.
How is San Francisco, Alex? Lovely city? Will you leave your heart there? Do you think it's a good place to die? Or how about Inspector Hughes? Do you like her? She's very pretty, isn't she? Just your type. Are you going to fuck Jamila? Better hurry then. Tempus fugit.
He hung up. I went back to work, lost myself for a couple of hours, began to make some minor progress. Around 4 o'clock, I was staring out at the start of rush hour, San Francisco style. Pretty mild, actually. While I talked to Kyle Craig. He was still at Quantico, but he was definitely heavily involved in the case. Kyle was in a position to choose the cases he became personally connected with, and he told me this was going to be one of them. We'd be working together again. I looked forward to it. I caught a movement out the corner of my eye and saw Jamila approaching my desk. She had her leather jacket half on and was struggling into the second sleeve. Going somewhere? Hold on, Kyle, I said into the receiver.
We have to go, she said, to San Luis Obispo. They're going to exhume a body. I think it's related.
I told Kyle that I had to leave right away. He wished me happy hunting. Jamila and I took the elevator down to the parking garage beneath the Hall of Justice. The more I saw of her work, the more I was impressed. Not just by her savvy, but by her enthusiasm for the job. A lot of detectives lose that after a couple of years. She obviously hadn't.
Are you going to fuck Jamila? Better hurry, then.
Are you always this pumped up? I asked her, once we were inside her blue Saab and heading out toward 101.
Yeah, pretty much, she said. I like the work. It's tough, but interesting. Honest, most of the time. I could do without the violence.
In this case in particular, the hangings give me the creeps. She looked over at me.
Speaking of life-threatening situations, you'd better buckle up. We've got a hike ahead of us, and I used to drive funny cars as a hobby. Don't be fooled by the Saab.
She wasn't kidding. According to the road signs, it was about 235 miles to San Luis Obispo. Heavy rain peppered the Saab most of the way. She still got us there by 8:30.
In one piece, too.
She nodded and winked as we whisked off the freeway at the San Luis Obispo exit. It looked like an idyllic spot, but we were there to exhume the corpse of a young girl. She had been hung, and her blood had been drained. Chapter 13. San Luis Obispo is a college town. Very pretty, at least from the outside looking in. We found Higuera Street and drove down it to Osos. Past small local shops, but also Starbucks, Barnes & Noble, the Firestone Grill. Jamila told me that you could always tell the time of day in San Luis Obispo by the scents and aromas, like barbecue smoke in the afternoon on Marsh Street, or the aroma of wheat and barley at night outside the SLO Brewing Company. We met Detective Nancy Goodis at the police station in town. She was a petite, attractive woman with a nice California tan, very much in charge of her homicide investigation. In addition to contacting us about this exhumation, she was also the lead on the murders of two students from Cal Poly that didn't seem related to our case, but who could tell for sure. Like most homicide detectives these days, she was busy.
We've got the permissions we need to exhume the body, Goodis told us on the way out to the cemetery. At least the rain had stopped for now. The air was warm, thanks to Santa Ana winds. What can you tell us about the murder, Nancy? You worked the case yourself, right? Jamila asked.
The detective nodded.
I did. So did just about every other detective in town. It was very sad, and an important case here. Mary Alice Richardson went to the Catholic high school in town. Her father's a well-liked doctor. She was a nice kid, but a bit of a wild child. What can I tell you? She was a kid, 15 years old.
What do you mean she was a wild child? I asked Detective Goodis.
She sighed and worked her jaw a little. I could tell this case had left a wound. She missed a lot of school, 2 or 3 days a week sometimes. She was bright enough, but her grades were just terrible. She hung with other kids who liked to experiment. Drugs like ecstasy, raves, black magic, heavy drinking, all-night parties, maybe even a little freebasing. Mary Alice was only arrested once, but she was giving her parents a lot of gray hairs.
Jamila asked,
Were you at the crime scene, Nancy?
I noticed that she was respectful of the other detective at all times. Very non-threatening toward her.
Unfortunately, I was. That's one of the reasons I worked so hard getting the permissions we needed to dig up her body. Mary Alice died 1 year and 3 months ago, but I will never, ever forget how we found her.
Jamila and I looked at each other. We hadn't heard all the particulars of the murder yet. We were still playing catch-up. Goodis continued.
It was pretty clear to me that she was meant to be found. Two kids from Cal Poly were the ones who actually discovered the body. They were parking out near the hills. It's a popular spot for submarine races. They went for a little moonlit stroll. I'm sure they had nightmares after what they saw. Mary Alice was hanging from a tree by her bare feet, naked, except the killers left her earrings and a small sapphire in her belly button. This wasn't a robbery.
How about her clothes, I asked.
We found the clothes. UFO parachute pants, Nikes, Chili Peppers t-shirt. No trophies were taken to our knowledge.
I glanced at Jamila. The killer trusts his or her memory, doesn't need trophies for some reason. Or so it seems. None of this follows any of the usual paths for serials.
No, it doesn't. I agree with that 100%. Do you know what scarification is? Detective Goodis asked.
I nodded. I've come across it, I said. Scars, wounds, most often on the legs and arms, occasionally the chest or back. They avoid the face because then people might make them stop. Usually the scars are self-inflicted.
Right, said Detective Goodis. Mary Alice had either cut herself over the past couple of months or someone else did it for her. She had over 70 separate cuts on her body, everywhere but the face.
The detective's white Suburban pulled onto a gravel road. Then we passed between rusted wrought iron gates.
We're here, Nancy Goodis announced. Let's get this over with.
Cemeteries make me twitchy. I hate what we're going to do. This makes me so sad. It made me sad, too. Chapter 14. I have yet to meet a relatively sane person who is anything but twitchy in a cemetery at night. I consider myself to be mildly sane. Therefore, I was twitchy. Detective Goodis was right. This was a very sad affair. A tragic conclusion to a young girl's life. The backdrop for the cemetery was the rolling foothills of the Santa Lucia Mountains. Three patrol cars from the police department in San Luis Obispo were already parked around the grave of Mary Alice Richardson. The medical examiner's van was parked nearby, plus two beat-up trucks without any clear identification on them. Four cemetery workers were digging up the grave in the bright light cast by the patrol car headlamps. The soil looked rich and loamy and was thick with worms. When the hole was of sufficient depth, a backhoe was brought in to do the bulk of the job. The police observers, including me, had nothing to do but stand impatiently around the grave. We drank coffee, exchanged small talk, cracked a few dark jokes, but nobody really laughed. I turned my cell phone off. I didn't need to hear from the mastermind or anybody else here in the cemetery. Around 1 in the morning, the container of the casket was finally uncovered by the cemetery workers. A lump rose in my throat, but I looked on. Beside me stood Jamila Hughes. She was shivering some, but sticking it out. Nancy Goodis had retreated to her Suburban. Smart lady. A crowbar was used to pry off the top of the liner. It made an unpleasant groaning noise, like someone in deep pain. The hole in the ground was approximately 6 feet deep, 8 feet long, less than 4 feet wide. Neither Jamila nor I spoke. Every detail of the exhumation held our attention now. My eyes blinked too rapidly in the eerie light. My breathing was uneven and my throat felt a little raw. I was recalling crime scene pictures of Mary Alice that I'd seen. 15 years old. Hung 2 feet off the ground by her ankles. Left that way for several hours. Drained of nearly all her blood. Another Class 4 death. Viciously bitten and stabbed. The victim in Washington hadn't been stabbed. So what did that mean? Why the variations on the murder theme? What did they do with all the blood? I almost didn't want to know the answers to the questions throbbing inside my head. Tattered gray canvas straps were carefully secured around the casket, and it was finally slowly raised out of the ground. My breathing was ragged, Suddenly, I felt guilty about being here. I had the thought that we shouldn't be disturbing this poor girl in her grave. It was an unholy thing to do. She had been violated enough.
I know, this sucks. I feel the same thing, Jamila said out of the side of her mouth. She lightly touched a hand to my elbow.
We have to do it. No other choice. We have to find out if it's the same killers.
I know. Why doesn't that make me feel any better about this? I muttered. I feel all hollowed out.
That poor girl. Poor Mary Alice. Forgive us, Jamila said.
A local funeral director who had consented to be on hand carefully opened the casket. Then he stepped back as if he had seen a ghost.
I moved forward to get my first look at the girl. I nearly gasped, and Jamila's hand went to her mouth.
A couple of the cemetery workers crossed themselves and bowed their heads low. Mary Alice Richardson was right there in front of us. She was wearing a flowing white dress, and her blonde hair was carefully braided. The girl looked as if she'd been buried alive. There had been virtually no decay of the body.
There's an explanation for this, the funeral director said to us. The Richardsons are friends of mine. They asked me if anything could be done to preserve their daughter for as long as possible. Somehow they knew their little girl would be seen again. The condition of the body, once interred, can be in any state of decay. It depends on the ingredients. I used an arsenic solution in the embalming process, the way we used to in the old days. You're looking at the result.
He paused as we continued to stare.
This is the way Mary Alice looked the day she was buried. This is the poor girl they murdered and hung.
Chapter 15. We got back to San Francisco from San Luis Obispo at 7 in the morning. I didn't know how Jamila could drive, but she did just fine. We forced ourselves to talk most of the way back, just to keep awake. We even had a few laughs. I was bone tired and could barely keep my eyes open. When I finally closed them inside my hotel room, I saw Mary Alice Richardson in her coffin. Inspector Hughes was drinking coffee at her desk when I arrived at the Hall of Justice at 2 o'clock that afternoon. She looked fresh and alert, none the worse for wear. She seemed to work as hard as I did on a case, maybe harder. I hoped it was a good thing for her. Don't you ever sleep? I asked, as I stopped to talk for a moment. My eyes went to the clutter in her workspace. I noticed a photograph of a smiling, very good-looking man propped on her desk. I was glad that she had time for a love life, at least. It made me think of Christine Johnson, who was now living out here on the West Coast. I felt a stab of rejection. The love of my life? Not anymore. Unfortunately, not anymore. Christine had left Washington and moved to Seattle. She liked it there a lot and was teaching school again. Jamila shrugged. I woke up around noon, couldn't get back to sleep. Maybe I'm too tired. The ME in Luis Obispo says he'll send us a report late today. But listen to this. I just got an email from Quantico. There have been 8 murders in California and Nevada that bear some resemblance to the Golden Gate Park ones. Not all the victims were hung, but they were bitten. The cases go back 6 years, so far. They're looking back even further than that.
What cities? I asked her.
She glanced down at her notes. Sacramento, our esteemed capital, San Diego, Santa Cruz, Las Vegas, Lake Tahoe, San Jose, San Francisco, San Luis Obispo. This is so goddamn creepy, Alex. One murder like this would be enough to keep me sleepless for a month.
Plus the murder in Washington, I said. I'm going to ask the Bureau to look at the East Coast. She grinned sheepishly.
I already did. They're on it.
I teased. So what do we do now?
What do cops always do when they wait? We eat donuts and drink coffee, she said, and rolled her dark brown eyes. She had a natural, very attractive beauty, even on just a few hours' sleep.
The two of us had a late breakfast at Roma's around the corner. We talked about the case. Then I asked her about other cases she'd solved. Jamila had a lot of confidence, but she was also modest about her contributions. I liked that about her. She definitely wasn't full of herself. When she had finished her omelet and toast, she sat there nervously tapping her finger against the table. She had several tics, seemed wired most of the time. I knew she was on the job again. What's the matter? I finally asked. You're holding something back, aren't you? She nodded.
I got a call from KRON-TV. They're close to doing a story that there have been several murders in California.
I frowned. How the hell did they find out?
She shook her head. Who knows? I'm going to give a reporter I know at the Examiner the okay to break the story first.
Hold on a second, I said. You sure about that?
I'm sure. I trust my friend as much as I trust anybody. He'll ground the story in reality, at least. Now help me figure out if there's anything we want the killers to read in the newspapers. It's the least my friend can do for us.
When we got back to the Hall of Justice, there was bad news. The killers had struck again. Chapter 16. It was another bad one. Another hanging. Two hangings, actually. Jamila and I split up as soon as we arrived at the murder scene in Mill Valley. We had different ways of doing things, different crime scene techniques. Somehow, though, I thought we would arrive at the same conclusions about this one. I could see the signs already. All of them bad. The two bodies were hung upside down from a rack used to hold copper pots. The scene of the murders was a contemporary kitchen inside a large, very expensive house. Dawn and Gavin Brody looked to be in their mid-30s. Like the other victims, they'd been drained of most of their blood. The first curiosity, although the Brodies were naked, the killers had left behind their jewelry, a pair of Rolex watches, wedding bands, a large diamond engagement ring, hoop earrings studded with countless small diamonds. The killers weren't interested in jewels or money, and possibly they wanted us to know it. So where were the victims' clothes? Had they been used to clean up the mess, to sop up blood? Was that why the killers had taken the clothing with them? They seemed to have interrupted the Brodies, who were both successful lawyers, while they were preparing a meal. Was there some symbolism involved here? Or dark humor? Was it a coincidence, or had they purposely attacked the couple at dinner time? Eat the rich? Several small-town police officers and also the FBI's techies were crowded into the kitchen with us. I figured that the damage had already been done by the Mill Valley Police. They were well-intentioned, but had probably never worked a major homicide before. I saw a few dusty footprints on the natural stone kitchen floor. I doubted they belonged to the killers or the Brodies. Jamila had made her way around the large kitchen and now came up to me. She'd seen enough already. She shook her head and really didn't have to say what she was thinking. The local police had messed up this crime scene pretty badly.
Oh, this is beyond strange, she finally said in a low whisper. These killers have so much hatred in them. I've never seen anything like it. The rage. Have you, Alex?
I looked into Jamila's eyes but said nothing. Unfortunately, I had.
Chapter 17. The story detailing a rampage of West Coast murders dominated the front page of the San Francisco Examiner. All hell had broken loose. William and Michael watched it unfold on TV that night. They were impressed with themselves, though they had expected the news story to break soon. They were counting on it, in fact. That was the plan. They were the special ones, the chosen team to get the job done. Now, they were on their mission, on the road again. They were chowing down at a diner in Woodland Hills, north of L.A., off I-5. People in the restaurant noticed the two of them. How could they not? Both were over 6 feet two, with blonde ponytails, strapping, well-muscled bodies, and dressed completely in black. William and Michael were the archetypes of modern boyhood. Wild animal meets entitled prince. The news was playing out on TV. The murders were the lead story, of course, and the sensationalized coverage lasted for several minutes. Frightened people in Los Angeles, Las Vegas, San Francisco, and San Diego were interviewed on camera and had the most incredibly insipid things to say. Michael frowned and then looked over at his brother. They've got it all wrong. Mostly wrong anyway. What idiots. What fucking drones. William took a bite of his dreary sandwich. Then he stared up at the TV again. Newspapers and TV always get it wrong, little brother. They're part of the larger problem. What has to be fixed, like those two lawyers in Mill Valley. You finished here? Michael wolfed down the remainder of his extra rare cheeseburger in a voracious bite.
I am, and I'm also hungry. I need to feed. His beautiful blue eyes were glazed. William smiled and kissed his brother on the cheek. Come on, then. I have a good plan for tonight. Michael held back. Shouldn't we be a little careful? The police are out looking for us, right? We're a big deal now. William continued to smile. He loved his brother's naivete. It amused him. We are an incredibly big deal. We're the next big thing. Come on, little brother, we both need to feed. We deserve it. And besides, the police don't know who we are. Always remember this. The police are incompetent fools. William drove their white van back down the road they had traveled through Woodland Hills before they had stopped at the diner. He was sorry they couldn't have brought the cat, but this trip was too long. He pulled the van into an obnoxiously lit shopping mall and studied the signs. Walmart, Denny's, Staples, Circuit City, Wells Fargo Bank. He despised every one of them as well as the people who shopped there. We're not looking for prey here, Michael asked. His bright blue eyes darted around the mall, and he looked concerned. William shook his head. The blonde ponytail wagged. No, of course not. These people aren't worthy of us, Michael. Well, maybe that blonde girl in the tight blue jeans over there is marginally worthy. Michael cocked his head sideways, then licked his lips. She'll do, for an appetizer. William hopped out of the van and walked to the far end of the parking lot. He was strutting a little, smiling, his head held high. Michael followed. The brothers crossed through the backyard of the Wells Fargo Bank, then the full parking lot of the Denny's restaurant, which William thought smelled of bacon grease and fat people. Michael began to smile when he saw what his brother was up to. They had done this kind of thing before. A somber black-and-white sign loomed straight ahead of them. It was backlit. Sorrel Funeral Home. Chapter 18. The back door to the funeral home took William less than a minute to crack open. It wasn't a problem since security was minimal. Now we feed, he said to Michael. He was starting to get excited, and his sense of smell led him to the embalming room. He discovered three bodies stored in the refrigerators. Two males and a female, he whispered. William quickly examined the bodies. They were fresh. Two had been embalmed, one hadn't. William knew about necrology, including what went on in funeral homes. The embalming process involved draining blood from the veins, then injecting a formaldehyde-based fluid. Tubes connected to pumps were inserted into the carotid artery and the jugular vein. The next step involved emptying the internal organs of their fluids. After that, much of the work was cosmetic. The jaws of the dead were wired shut. The lips were arranged and sealed with some kind of glue. Eye caps were placed under each eyelid to prevent the eyeballs from sinking into the head. William pointed to a centrifuge, which was used to drain bodies of blood and other fluids. He laughed. We won't be needing that tonight. All his senses were heightened. He felt larger than life. His night vision was excellent. Nothing more than the illumination from a table lamp would be needed. He opened a refrigerator and took the unembalmed body in his arms. He carried the corpse, a woman in her early 40s, to a nearby porcelain table. William looked at his brother and gently rubbed his hands together. He took a deep breath. They had raided funeral homes before, and though it didn't compare to a fresh kill, prey was prey. Besides, the dead woman was a fairly good physical specimen for her age. She was attractive and compared favorably to the female they had attacked and fed upon in San Francisco. There was a name tag on the body, Diana Ginn. I hope some funeral director didn't have Diana first, William said to his brother. Pathetic geeks sometimes took jobs at funeral homes so they could ravage the dead at their leisure. They'd do unnecessary searches into vaginal and anal cavities. Another kinky pastime was to have sex with the dead in a coffin. It happened more than people could imagine. William found that he was excited. There was nothing to compare to this. He climbed up onto the embalming table and poised himself above the woman. Diana Ginn's naked body was ashen, but pretty enough in the dim light. Her lips were full and blue. He wondered how she had died,
Since she didn't look sick, there were no obvious wounds. She hadn't been in an accident. William carefully pried open the eyelids, looked into her eyes. "Hello, my sweet girl. You're beautiful, Diana," he whispered dreamily. "That isn't just a cheap pickup line, I mean it. You're extraordinary. You're worthy of tonight, of Michael and me, and we will be worthy of you." He let his fingers lightly graze her cheeks, then the woman's long neck, her breasts, which weren't pert now, but more like sacks of pudding. He studied the intricate lines of her veins, so beautiful. He was almost dizzy with lust for Diane again. While William crouched low over the body, his brother lightly stroked the woman's bony feet, her thin ankles, then slowly, lovingly, moved his hands up the long legs. He was moaning softly, as if he were trying to waken her from the deepest sleep. "We love you," Michael whispered. "We know you can hear us. You're still here in your body, aren't you? We know, Diana. We know exactly how you feel. We're the undead."
Chapter 19. I continued to be impressed with the tremendous discipline and hard work of Jamila Hughes. What drove her? Something buried in her past? Something more obvious in the present? The fact that she was one of two female homicide inspectors in the San Francisco Police Department? Maybe all of the above? Jamila had already told me that she hadn't taken a day of comp time in almost 2 years. That sounded kind of familiar. A couple of times during the next day at the Hall of Justice, I mentioned her incredible work ethic, but she shrugged it off. She was well respected by the other homicide inspectors. She was a regular person, no false airs, no bullshit about her. I found out that she had a nickname. It fit her. Jam. I spent a couple of hours in the afternoon finding out what I could about tigers. Area zoos and shelters were being canvassed in an attempt to locate every single tiger in California. The murderous cat was our best lead so far. I was keeping my own list of facts, different things that struck me. Someone was able to command and control the tiger before and after it attacked and bit Davis O'Hara in Golden Gate Park. An animal trainer? A vet? The jaw of a tiger is so strong that it can crush bone and then pulverize it, and yet someone was able to call the tiger off its prey. All tiger species are considered endangered. Their existence is being challenged by both loss of habitat and poaching. Could the killers also be environmentalists? Tigers are being poached for their suspected healing powers. Almost every part of the cat is considered valuable, and in some cases sacred. Tigers have magical significance in some cultures, especially in parts of Africa and Asia. Could that be important to the case? I had lost track of the time, and when I looked up from my note-taking, it was already getting dark outside. Jamila was striding down the corridor in my direction. She had on her long black leather jacket and looked ready to leave. She'd put on lipstick. Maybe she had a date. She looked terrific. "Tiger, tiger, burning bright," she recited a line from Blake's poem. I answered with the only other line I could remember. "Did he who made the lamb make thee?" She looked pensive. Then she smiled. What a team. The poet detectives. Let's get a beer. I'm pretty beat, and I have a few more files to check. I think I'm still jet-lagged. Even as I was saying the words, I wasn't sure why the hell I was saying them. She put up her hand. "All right already. You could have just said, no, you're not my type. Jeez, man. I'll see you in the morning. But thanks for all your help. I mean that." I saw her smile as she turned, then walked away down the long hall to the elevators. But then I saw her shake her head. After she was gone, I sat at the desk overlooking the streets of San Francisco. I sighed and then I shook my head. I could feel a familiar weariness settling in. I was alone again and I had no one to blame. Why had I turned Jamila down for a couple of beers? I liked her company. I didn't have any other plans, and I wasn't that jet-lagged. But I thought I knew the reason. It wasn't too complicated. I had gotten close to my last two partners on homicide cases. Both were women I liked. Both had died. The mastermind was still out there. Could he be in San Francisco right now?
Was Jamila Hughes safe in her own city?